I'm Sarah Schwartz-Sachs, and this is the Jamaica Plain Forum podcast, with community conversations on the great issues of the day. Visit us online at www.jamaicaplainforum.org to find out about upcoming events. And subscribe to our podcast to take us with you everywhere you go. The Jamaica Plain Forum is a program of the First Church in Jamaica Plain Unitarian Universalist and the Institute for Policy Studies. Podcast recorded and produced by David Goodman of the Independent Broadcast Information Service, ibisradio.org. Technical support for this podcast comes from the folks at quilted.org.
Welcome to the Jamaica Plain Forum. My name is Chuck Collins. The back door on your right. There's also a bathroom on the second level. We record these programs for WMUA and for our own website, so we keep the word moving around. Any donations you make help us offset the cost of heat and the use of the space, so if you haven't been able to give a donation and would like to, please do. We welcome your suggestions of future events. People hear about speakers coming to town or films that you think that would be good for the forum, let us know. Sarah Schwartz-Sachs is our wonderful coordinator. She sort of makes these events happen. So she can be reached at the forum website. We also would ask if you know people, talk up future forums, make a dinner date, and invite somebody to come to the forum. That's how the word spreads. A couple things I want to let you know about coming up. On Tuesday, February 17th, Kim Fellner, who actually works with Working America, some of you may know her from her work in the labor movement, wrote a book recently about Starbucks called Wrestling with Starbucks, Cappuccino Conscious and Capital or something like that. Anyway, she's going to be here in the neighborhood. She's doing very similar to Kim. She's doing the Harvard Trade Union in the afternoon and coming to see us in the evening. So we hope that you'll come out and hear Kim. She has a very thoughtful take on sort of Starbucks. And on Friday, February 20th, we have a report from Bolivia. We have an international solidarity group that's coming in, both people from Bolivia and from the U.S. who work on solidarity issues on Bolivia. So we have a sort of update report. It'll be kind of a multimedia, multicultural program, so that'll be fun. And on February 27th, we have a film called The Aruzi Persian Wedding, and we have a card on the table back there that describes this film, and that's one of our ITVS films. And we have if you haven't been here in a while, we have a brand new screen that kind of almost fills up this entire area, and a new sound system. So people said, screen too small, we got a big screen. People said, can see it now, can't hear, got a new sound system. So we respond to those requests. So all this is on the website. Tonight, Kim Bobo's program is co-sponsored by our friends at Massachusetts Jobs with Justice, Dollars and Cents Magazine, which has brought some books and publications, and the Boston Review, and other groups like Institute for Policy Studies. We're going to have Kim speak for a bit, and then we'll have discussion. Let me just say that the Jamaica Plain Forum, we're doing a bunch of events related to the economic crisis, and I consider this one of them. Clearly, increasing the clout of labor is a key part of how we're going to turn the economy around. I have known Kim Bobo for over 20 years. When I was the director of the Home Coalition here in Massachusetts, which was working on homelessness and housing issues, Kim came in and trained our organizers and helped us do campaign strategy. And when she was with the Midwest Academy, any of you ever have been trained by the Midwest Academy or seen some of the manuals? Terrific books. I happen to know that if we wheeled that piano over here, she could also lead us in song. She is a mother of twins. She is one of the most dynamic. I sort of thought when she had twins, I thought, God has a sense of humor, because I thought Kim has so much energy and she's, you know, and that she got twins. And she could handle it. She could take it on. She's just that kind of organized. Having twins is an organizing challenge, right? So, but her work, she really was the founder of Interfaith Worker Justice, where she really brought her deep understanding of faith-based communities to working on issues of concern to workers, and drawing from the faith tradition, looking at the issues of dignity for workers. So her new book, out by the New Press, Wage Theft in America, sort of looks at all the ways in which employers pick the pockets of their workers and what we should do about it. And, you know, since she didn't get appointed to be the Secretary of Labor, we're hoping that she'll tell us what the Secretary of Labor should be doing in the coming months. So please welcome Kim Bobo.
Thank you so much. Great to be here on this cold. Let me just tell you how I got to some of this wage theft stuff and how I ended up writing a book on wage theft, which, you know, you don't wake up thinking, oh, let me write a book on wage theft, right? So I helped start Interfaith Worker Justice about 12 years ago, and our main mission was to engage the religious community in labor issues. And I viewed that primarily as that we were going to work on labor union campaigns and support campaigns. And for the first few years, that's really all we did around the country and started building a network of religion labor groups around the country. But then random pastors started referring workers that would come to them with problems to us. And then I'd call my friends in labor and say, oh, I've got two workers over here who've got a problem, and could you help them? And they'd say, well, no, I don't think so. So, we decided in several of the places around the country, we started saying, well, maybe we should just do a few worker rights materials. So in Chicago, I mean, I would take some of these calls, right, where workers hadn't been paid or they were being abused or whatever. And I didn't really know the labor laws all that well. And so I assigned one of our Lutheran Volunteer Corps interns to do a two-week project to write a labor rights manual. Well, about 6 months later, we had a worker rights manual. And you would think in a city like Chicago that there would already exist a labor manual, right? But there was no labor manual in the labor city of Chicago. We did this manual, and, you know, we published it in English, Spanish, and Polish. And so then I thought, well, you know, so when workers call, we can just send them the manual. So we started sending the manual, and then more people called, right, because they thought we were the experts on this stuff. And it's like, this is not working, right? So out of this, we ended up creating in Chicago a worker center, and then started creating some worker centers around in different places. And that is clearly what was happening simultaneously around the country, where the crisis of wage theft and the lack of pushback forces in the society resulted in workers just having no place to turn. And so out of that emerged this worker center network. It's through really the worker center network that I came to become so familiar with wage theft, because it's all the worker centers talk about, because every worker that comes in has had their wages stolen. Now, some of them had been injured too, some of them have had discrimination, but they've almost all not been paid for their work. So that's sort of where I enter sort of the issues of wage theft. Started out to write a book on a new vision for the Department of Labor, because our worker centers have tried over the last 6 or 7 years to partner with the Department of Labor. And it has not been an easy experience. In fact, it's been a pretty bad experience. And, you know, we had some relations actually before Bush administration. And then I tried to build a relationship with the first wage and hour administrator. And that was okay. And then they had a second wage and hour administrator. And, you know, I got to know them. By the third one, when I had sued the Department of Labor to get all the names of people owed back wages, we had kind of a rough start on that relationship. And by the fourth guy, I just gave up, right? You know, this is a waste of our time trying to do it. And yet, you know, I knew that we've got to have a strong Department of Labor. And so I actually started off this spring, I had a few months sabbatical from my office, to write a monograph on a new vision for the Department of Labor. Actually, a couple of my staff said, "What is a monograph? What's a short book? You know, just a little book." And yet, as I started to write why we needed a new vision of labor, I had to explain that we had this huge crisis of wage theft in the country. And then I had to explain, well, how do employers steal wages? Because people didn't quite get it. And then I had to explain, well, why does it happen? And before you knew it, it was just a book on wage theft. So that's kind of how I got to this. So let me just kind of review stuff that you know so well about wage theft here in Boston and here around the country. I come to this out of interfaith worker justice, so I really come to it because these are core fundamental religious values, right? The text of Deuteronomy says, "Do not take advantage of a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether the worker is a fellow Israelite or an immigrant living in one of your towns. Pay the worker the wages each day before sunset, because the worker is poor and is counting on it. Otherwise, the worker may cry to the Lord against you, and you will be guilty of sin." It's pretty clear, don't you think? It's pretty clear. And I'm here to tell you there's a little sin around the country right now. In fact, there's a lot of sin around the country. I did a forum in New York City, and there were a bunch of people from the New York City Department of Labor, and I was reading this scripture, and they were writing it down. They said, "That's in the Bible?" Yeah. It's in the Bible, right? And the Quran says similar stuff. It says, "Don't let the sweat on your brow dry before you pay the worker," right? Same thing, right? The principles are really clear. So what is wage theft? All right, you guys know this, but let me go through it really quickly, at least what I outline in the book as sort of the major ways that employers steal wages. They steal wages by not paying the minimum wage. You guys see that at the workers' center, right? What kind of workers don't get paid the minimum wage?
Pretty much all of them.
Lots of them. Okay. You know, the estimates are that it's somewhere 2 to 3 million workers aren't paid the minimum wage. I suspect it's even higher than that. You know, the wildest story on this was the story in the New York Times about the Saigon Grill. 36 delivery guys delivering food out, you know, for a la-di-da restaurant in Manhattan. They worked 70 to 80 hours a week. They were paid a salary monthly of $5.20. Works out to $2 an hour, less than $2 an hour is what they were paid, Saigon Grill. And when you read the court settlement on it, in addition to that, if they didn't type stuff into the computer fast enough about where they were going, they fined them $20. If they slammed the door too loud as they went out the door, fined them another $20, right? So wage theft, minimum wage, huge issue. Misclassifying workers as independent contractors. About 3 million workers, it's estimated, are misclassified as independent contractors. It's such a problem that a number of states, including Massachusetts, has put together a misclassification task force to really try and go after it. But if you talk to anybody in the construction trades, operating engineers, right, tell us about this.
Well, I actually work in the maintenance end of it, but I know from the construction side, yeah, people are paid similar work, you know, long hours, paid, maybe paid a month later, or paid at all, or the job ends and they're gone. And it's primarily immigrant workers in Boston, a lot of Brazilian workers for construction work, and they're notorious for being misclassified as consultants or or independent contractors. If paid, paid way below the minimum wage, no overtime.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we did a number of religious delegations to talk to Pulte Homes workers. And Pulte, this is the nation's largest home builder, right? So this is not some small mom-and-pop shop. So we sent out religious delegations to talk to these folks building Pulte Homes. Every single worker was paid as an independent contractor. They work 60, 70 hours a week. When you averaged it out, you know, certainly no overtime. Some of them wasn't even minimum wage. All considered independent contractors. And it not only steals from the workers, but it's fraud against the government, right? It's fraud. Now, misclassification sounds like just like you filled out your paperwork wrong, right? And it sounds kind of innocuous, but it's a really serious thing because if you're paid as an independent contractor instead of as an employee, what happens? What aren't you covered with?
Unemployment.
What else? Workers' comp. Uh-huh. What else? Social Security, Medicare. Absolutely. So it really steals from the public coffers as well as stealing from workers. Huge, huge problem. Actually, the funniest thing is I've done a bunch of radio interviews, thanks to Betsy and her colleague, lots of radio interviews, in fact. And I've had two or three folks that have been interviewing me when I've described misclassification. They've said, "Hey, that's happening to me." Interview. So it's like, it's
cool. It's a big problem with WGBH, but the other thing is you can't unionize because you're an independent contractor.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Uh-huh. And?
Another tactic in construction that happens is they'll actually bring people in from another country or another part of the country, like the U.S., and house them, work them their 60 or 70 hours, and then take from them what it costs, the rent, even though they're sharing.
Deduct it, right.
The job's done, they're gone, which prevents them from taking action. You know, they're shipped in and shipped out to do a 3-week to 6-week job.
Interesting. Not paying overtime for folks who are still called employees, so they're not misclassified, they're called employees, but they're not paid overtime. A conservative business think tank estimated that $19 billion a year was stolen from workers on not paying them overtime. Most attorneys I deal with say it's probably way more than that. It's probably $40, $50 billion is stolen from not paying overtime from workers. And, you know, you guys had, like, the classic on this. The Bianco factory in New Bedford, that was quite something, right, where they clock the workers out at 5 o'clock and then clock them in at 5:30 to use the same machine but under another name, so that they could avoid paying overtime. You know, $7.20 an hour, they're paying these workers on a government contract, right? A government contract. Clearly wage theft. Or then you have Sure-Bright Car Wash in Nashville, Tennessee. This is one where, you know, given all these accolades as a company because they hired ex-offenders and they hired homeless guys. And what happened is when a car would drive in, they would clock the workers in. When the car went out, they would clock them out, right? So they'd be on the job for 12 to 14 hours a day, but only get paid for 6 or 7 hours a day. And I'm told that happens at car washes all over the nation right now. Notorious industry. Or the biggest shaver of wages is clearly Walmart. Right? So Walmart, the nation's largest employer, on December 24th made a public announcement, presumably so no one would be paying any attention, that they're going to try to settle 62 lawsuits that they have out for stealing wages. And they've primarily stolen it by not paying for workers' lunch hours. You know, they work through the lunch hours, they don't pay them. They work through their breaks, they don't pay them. And then their managers go into the computer records, find the workers that it says they worked 43, 44 hours, and shave it back to only 40 hours, right? It's called shaving wages. And they've done it all over the country. They're going to end up paying somewhere between $300 and $600 million in stolen wages. And that's probably a drop in the bucket compared to what they actually owe. All right.
Can I suppose?
Yes, of course. They're settling. They've agreed to settle these lawsuits, right?
Oh, right. You said that.
Mm-hmm. They're actually about 70 lawsuits out against them, and they're trying to settle 62 of them. And there's a few of them where the folks who've raised the suit don't want to be in the group settlement. And they've already paid $45 million out on one lawsuit in Minnesota for stealing wages. So, again, it's just going to be hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's not really going to hurt them, right, because they've stolen so many wages over the years. And then there's tip stealing. So if you go to a restaurant, you should assume that half of the restaurants are stealing money, because that's what every Department of Labor survey says, is that half of restaurants steal money from workers. Now, not always from the wait staff, often from the back of the house folks, but there's a lot of tip stealing going on, whether it's in your local restaurants. Like, I went to Tank Noodle, my favorite noodle shop in Chicago. I went to the restaurant. I'm going to pay my bill on the credit card. I turned to the wait staff. You know, if I put my tip on the credit card, will you get it? And she says, no. Just flat out no, right? You know, so ask every time you're going to put it on the credit card. And you know all those little tips that you put in the little jar at Starbucks and at Dunkin' Donuts, right? Well, there's lawsuits out against both of those companies for managers taking those tips, right? So you can't be sure that the tips in the cup get there either. And then there's the last paycheck problem, which is a huge and growing problem. So you decide to quit your job. You may not get your last paycheck. You get fired from your job, particularly your boss is mad at you. You're certainly not going to get your last paycheck. And if your plant closes down like Republic Doors and Windows did in Chicago, your plant may tell you that we're going to pay you for 3 days instead of the 60 days that the WARN Act clearly says. Wage theft in terms of last paycheck in this economic environment is a growing and expanding problem of serious dimensions. I literally 2 days ago, I was talking to a woman that runs a big social service agency in Chicago, and I was saying, you know, asking her, are they seeing any problems with people on wages and paychecks? She said, oh, my word, we're completely overwhelmed about people who've been laid off and not paid their last paycheck, right? So I think it's actually an area where the worker centers are going to see, you know, to the extent that most of the worker centers around the country have been serving predominantly immigrant workers. I think we're going to see kind of a different set of folks that we have the opportunity to work with. And it's kind of like we're going to have to not stop doing that, but figure out, are there some other things we can offer on this last paycheck, because it's a huge problem. So, in fact, it is billions of dollars stolen from millions of workers. And while certainly immigrants are the most exploited in the society, it does injustice to the issue to suggest this is only an immigrant problem. It certainly is not. A friend of mine is doing a survey on the west side of Chicago, which is predominantly African American in Chicago, and doing a survey of, you know, workers having problems in the workplace. And he said to me, you know, Kim, it's exactly what you would think, right? People aren't getting paid, they're not getting paid overtime, they're misclassified, and last pay, it's the exact same problems. And so while immigrants are the most exploited, in fact, probably the biggest dollar figures are being stolen from non-immigrants. You know, I was in the elevator today coming out of a building on Summer Street, and there were two big FedEx guys in the elevator. And, you know, I was talking to them, right? They're paid as independent contractors, right? That's nuts, right? independent contractors, they work for FedEx, right? They have a route, they have hours, they have days, right? They're clearly employees. I said, how's the lawsuit going on this? Oh, we sure hope it wins because we really want to be employees and not independent contractors, right? It's all around us, right? So, you know, 50% of restaurants, 100% of poultry plants, 60% of nursing homes, 90% of landscapers, 75% of farm workers, 75 to 90 depending on the city, garment industry is stealing wages. It is all around us, and it's not small amounts of money. Okay, so why are we having this kind of wage theft? Well, clearly it's about greed. You know, we had greed in Deuteronomy. We have greed right now. But it's greed unchecked by adequate pushback forces in the society. So I want to talk briefly about what I see as the main pushback forces in the society. Clearly, the most important pushback force against wage theft is a union. If you have a union, you're not going to have wage theft. The problem with that in our society is that fewer than 10% of workers are represented by unions. So until we get, fewer than 10%. Yeah. So until we get the Employee Free Choice Act passed, what's that?
And that number went up this year for the first time in quite a while.
Oh, good. Good. All right. Good, good, good. But unless we can get the Employee Free Choice Act passed, I think it will be hard for unions to play the kind of role that they could play in society. Let me stop. Does everyone know about the Employee Free Choice Act in the room? Okay, let me explain it. The Employee Free Choice Act is a very simple bill that will make it easier for workers to organize and to get contracts. Now, the bill is very controversial, but it shouldn't be. But let me tell you what it does. It does three simple things. First thing it does is it allows workers to sign a card and say, I'd like to be represented by a union. And then if over half the workers sign the cards, then they can have a union automatically. Right now what happens is you have to first sign the card, and then you turn the cards in, and then your employer gets to decide whether the employer is going to recognize those cards and let you have a union, or whether the employer is going to say, no, I'm not sure about those cards. We want to have an election in the workplace, right? And then there's this 6-8 week period where the employer just pulls out all the stops in terms of, you know, movies showing unions doing horrible things to workers, and they take you aside and tell you one-on-one on how bad unions are. And anyway, this whole environment, 85% of employers run this kind of anti-union campaign. And at the end of it, you know, a lot of folks are like, oh, you know, if the employer's going to go this crazy about a union, maybe we shouldn't have one, right? I mean, it really is intimidating for workers. And so what this bill does, it just simply turns it around and makes it the worker's choice instead of the employer's choice in terms of whether or not they get to have a union. Second thing it does is sometimes, a lot of times for workers, it's hard to get that first contract. So the bill says if you can't get that first contract, it's going to go to arbitration and or to mediation and then to binding arbitration to make sure you get that first contract. Third thing it does is it increases the fines and penalties for employers who harass and intimidate workers. Now, that's all the bill does, but it would dramatically shift what happens in many workplaces, because you talk to any group of workers, and I've done this for years now, and you say, what would happen if you tried to organize a union in your workplace? And almost everybody says, well, I'd be fired. Right? Now, whether or not that's even true, it doesn't matter. If that's the collective image, then it puts this incredible damper on organizing. And to say we have the right to organize and yet everyone believes you're going to get fired if you do and that there'll be no protection, well, that's not much of a right, is it? So, and half of workers in this country say they'd like to have a union in their workplace. So, you know, if we could get this bill passed, it would dramatically change things. But it is, in fact, going to be a huge fight. Now, the Massachusetts delegation is all in support of the Employee Free Choice Act. And so the campaign is to get them to all be champions of the bill. And so I urge you, if you're talking to them, to encourage them to not just support it, but to be champions of this important piece of legislation. Second pushback factor, I think, are these worker centers. And the worker centers really are like the settlement houses at the turn of the century. They're like the Catholic labor schools or the Jewish labor lyceums that happened from the 30s to the 50s. It's really an alternative structure to support workers because the other systems out there are really failing them right now. And I just see these worker centers as just an incredible, important institution for moving the fight against wage theft forward. Third pushback force is the ethical business community, which is completely missing in action right now. Now, they should be out there, right, because an employer who's stealing wages undercuts an ethical business person who's trying to pay people fairly and rightly. And yet, we see very few ethical business leaders speaking out on these issues. In fact, we see none. Now, you know, I'm hoping that collectively we can change that, right? You know, I've got some conversations going with, you know, Business for Social Responsibility, and I'm having some conversations with a few business schools in religious schools. And, you know, we're hoping we can, you know, get some conversation, but right now they're missing in action. Fourth pushback set of folks who's really carrying a lot of the weight on this one for us as a society are the trial lawyers. Now, the trial lawyers get kind of a bad rap in our society, but I'm telling you, they're doing the heavy lifting on this issue of wage theft. They are filing lawsuits for groups of workers. It's those 62 lawsuits against Walmart that is resulting in Walmart settling. It is not the Department of Labor doing that, right? It's 62 private lawyers who filed all that those suits for us. Right now, this last year, there were 7,000 suits filed in federal court under the Fair Labor Standards Act, right? So on the that's the law that does the minimum wage and overtime. It's kind of the core law on these issues. 7,000 suits filed, 151 of them were by the Department of Labor. All the rest of them were by private attorneys. They're clearly doing the heavy lifting on this issue. The problem is that works if there's 50 or 100 or 500 workers. It doesn't work if one worker didn't get his or her last paycheck. No attorney's going to take that case, right? Or if it's even five workers that, you know, are short $1,000 each in overtime. No attorney's going to take that case. And so as important as the private bar has been on this, it is not an adequate solution for stopping wage theft as a whole in the society, which is why we've got to have a strong Department of Labor, which is really the fifth pushback force is the federal and the state enforcement. So I want to talk a little bit about particularly the federal Department of Labor. But before I do, let me acknowledge that Massachusetts is one of a handful of states that is really trying to ramp up its enforcement and is doing actually a good job and has maybe not enough resources, which is a common problem, but at least there's a will to try to do something here in Massachusetts. And I know that that will has probably come about because a bunch of you have been pushing to get that will. But it really, you're starting to lead the nation in trying to think about how to do this work creatively. But good states like Massachusetts are important, but again, they are no substitute for the federal Department of Labor taking this on, because half of the states in the nation have fewer than 15 enforcement staff, right? So half of them really have no capacity to do any enforcement at the state level. And then you have states like Florida, which they used to have a Department of Labor, and then they voted it out. The state legislature voted to get rid of the Department of Labor. It was so bizarre. So 4 years ago, you all may have remembered that we got in Florida, they had a ballot initiative to raise the minimum wage. Do people remember that they voted for Bush, and then they voted 2-1 to raise the minimum wage on the ballot initiative? And they did. So it was higher than the federal minimum wage. But there was no one in the entire state to enforce it. Absolutely no one. And, in fact, if you went to the Florida Department of Labor website, it had this little message on it that said, the state legislature disbanded us. The state's attorney general may enforce the minimum wage. May. So one of my staff called the state's attorney general and said, so this is what the website says. Are you enforcing the minimum wage? And they said, I didn't know we were supposed to enforce the minimum wage. They had never once enforced it, right? They didn't even know they were supposed to be doing it. And then, you know, Alabama, my favorite state, Alabama, right? They have three enforcement staff, and all they are authorized to do is call the employer and try to ask the employer to please pay the person back. And if the employer says no, then they just say, well, have a good day, right? I mean, there's nothing else. There's no follow-up. I mean, so again, we can't rely on the states, right? I know there's a whole reason why we have states' rights, but I'm not in favor of it, I have to tell you. On things like wage enforcement, it really doesn't make any sense. So let's talk about the Federal Department of Labor, because we need a strong Federal Department of Labor. So I have in the book a lot of recommendations, but I'm just going to share six of them with you tonight. So first recommendation for the Department of Labor is that we need some good leadership in there. Our previous lady, Elaine Chao, she wasn't so good. In fact, before she got the job, she had never done anything related to labor. Absolutely nothing. Now, you might ask how she got the job, but that's another story, right? But I'm excited about Hilda Solis, right? She's the President Obama's nominee for Secretary of Labor, and let's hope she gets confirmed fairly soon. By the way, for those of you who haven't been following, her nomination has been held up because of her support for the Employee Free Choice Act. And she will have next to nothing to do with the Employee Free Choice Act in her job. But, you know, it's just kind of an ideological battle right now, which is why they've held it up. But she has the right background. She has the right inclination. And we got to make sure she's got a strong team around her. First, we got to have strong leadership. Second, we got to have community partnerships. You know our Northwest Arkansas Workers Center. Well, I don't know if they told you, they filed 30 wage and hour claims with the Department of Labor in Northwest Arkansas. And it's not like everybody in Northwest Arkansas is filing wage claims, right? There's no one but us doing that there. And they followed up on one of them. And then we call and try and say, well, what was wrong with the 29 other cases that we gave you? And they won't return our phone call, right? You know, we're doing their job, and they won't return our phone calls, right? That's nuts out there. So we got to have a commitment from the wage and hour division. That's the one that enforces these laws, that they're going to work with us. You know, the police departments learned a long time ago that if you want to deal with drug dealers and find out where they are, you do community policing, right? You have a partnership with the community, right? Same thing on this wage theft. If we want to find out where wage theft is, you got to have a partnership with worker centers, with unions, with trial lawyers, with the religious community. We got to have a community partnership around stomping out wage theft. Now, the good news on this is New York State just announced last week a new neighborhood wage watch. I like the sound of that, don't you? Neighborhood wage watch, right? Anyway, they're trying to do just what we're talking about, pulling in a whole team of folks to go after folks. So, you know, I think we can do it at the national level, not just at the state level. Third, we need accountability and transparency. If I want to go to a restaurant in Chicago, I can type into the health department's database and I can find out about every health inspection that every restaurant in Chicago has had. Right? But if I want to find out how they're paying their workers, I can't find a single thing anywhere. Well, you know, I would make choices about where I went based on how employers treated their workers. And I think everyone in this room would do the same thing. But we can't do it if we don't have some information. So we got to get that Department of Labor to be a bit more transparent and accountable to us. And I know even the good guys at the Department of Labor, and this one's going to be a bit of a barrier. Fourth recommendation is kind of the one that's going to be a bit challenging, is that we just got to have more cops on the job, right? We got to have more investigators. There's fewer than 750 investigators to protect 130 million workers in the nation. That's just not enough investigators. In 1941, when they were responsible for 15 million workers, they had 1,700 investigators out around the country. At that point in 1941, they physically visited 1 out of 10 workplaces, right? And if you visit the workplace, you're going to find the problems, right? Right now, they just sit in their offices because they don't have enough staff to go around. Every single wage and hour investigator I've talked to, they describe their work as triage, right? Just doing the best job they can. And they work hard, right? They're good folks, really care about this. They can't possibly do the job without more staff. People say, how can we get more staff? Clearly, if we want to have more staff, we can have more staff, right? There have been all these folks who've been investigating all these forms that they've made unions fill out. So we could probably eliminate a few of those staff and move them over. My main recommendation on this is that we stop the workplace raids and we take all those big guys who are kind of aggressive, right, and we put them on wage and hour. Let them come after the employers instead of the immigrant workers, right? Anyway, and there's thousands of them, so think how, you know, we could have like kind of a robust department here. Might have to have a little retraining, but... and then there's also the 52,000 folks taking my toothpaste out of my suitcase. So I'm sure we can figure out how to get more investigators on the job, but we gotta have them. We can't think about seriously doing this job with only 750 investigators. We gotta have targeted investigations. You know, if you and I know the industries that are stealing wages, so does the Department of Labor, and they need to go after them. Last week, I was talking to a wage and hour investigator in Minneapolis who was telling me about the Chinese buffets in the Twin Cities area and actually throughout Minnesota. And I immediately, my ears perked up because I said, oh, I know the Chinese buffets in Chicago. We went after them and found a slave ring, right, where they were housing them in dormitories. They were working them 12 and 14 hours a day. There was no minimum wage. They would work, 14 days straight with no days off. It was a slave ring, right? They were bringing them in. And we actually filed some cases and got them convicted of running a slave ring. And this guy starts describing this stuff in Minneapolis, exact same thing. He says, it's all over the Midwest. The Chinese buffets all over the Midwest are, they're doing them out of slave ring operations. And I'm like, why, aren't we going after them, right? If we all know this, let's go after these industries. This is totally ridiculous. But they're not, and they're not in large part because they don't have the staff to do it. So if they can get enough staff, then they need to do targeted investigations versus complaint-based investigations, which is what they do now, which is, I'm an investigator, I answer the phone, you call me, you've got a problem, I respond to your complaint, I don't do anything about the whole industry or even that whole plant, right? That doesn't make any sense right now. And finally, for the Department of Labor, they got to have some meaningful penalties for people who steal wages. A few months ago, I was running late to a meeting at my office, and I came to an intersection right near my office that had this big sign that said, no right turn on red. But I was late, right? So I look through the intersection, don't see anybody, I make my turn, park in the parking lot, get to my meeting on time, I'm good. A week later, I get a picture of my car in the mail, right? And a $100 fine, right? Well, I'm not going to turn red there, right on red there anymore, right? Because I don't want to pay a $100 fine, and I know I'm going to get one if I turn right on red. We need to have that kind of immediate consequence for employers who steal wages, right? You need to have a penalty that you care about. And right now, if you stole $2,000, what's your name again? I forgot. Sarah, and what's your name?
Will,
okay. So if Sarah steals $2,000 from Will, and Will gets upset and files a claim with the Department of Labor, I'm going to call Sarah, and I'm going to say, Sarah, Will says you stole $2,000 from him by not paying him minimum wage and overtime. I need you to go ahead and pay him. And you say to me, you know, my records show different. I only owe $1,000, and I'll go ahead and settle on $1,000, but I ain't going to give you that $2,000. And I'm going to say, Sarah, that'd be good. Just sign this waiver right here and give me that $1,000. And Will's going to get 50 cents on the dollar. That's what happens with most workers who have their wages stolen. They get 50 cents on the dollar. Not that the investigator doesn't want to get it all, but the investigator doesn't have time to track this stuff down. And so they settle for 50 cents on the dollar. So it becomes like a good business model, right? You pay less than you should have paid in the first place. And there aren't fines. You don't get fined. Particularly the first time, and even the second time. You steal wages, you're caught, and you steal wages again, only 40% of them will pay any fine at all. And it's a meaningless number for most employers. So the penalties are not adequate right now. Now, I thought when I started working on the book that we had to completely change the law, that they didn't have enough penalties available to them. They have plenty of penalties. They just haven't had the will to enforce things. And so I think what most people believe we need to have is some sort of mandatory fines and penalties that go with collecting the back wages. So there's, you know, it's not a discussion. You steal wages, you're going to have a penalty. Because people need to be fearful of the Department of Labor. And no one is scared of the Department of Labor right now. And they should, you know, for good reason. They're not doing anything. So that was like most of the book. Then the last couple chapters really are what we can do about this. And unlike many of the problems facing the nation. Now, Chuck has answers to a lot of these things, and he can explain the economic crisis and what we can do about it. But it's a little complicated, I think. But stopping wage theft, frankly, is not all that complicated, right? We know what to do to stop wage theft. We can. You know, this is not rocket science on how to change this stuff. So let me just give you a few things you can do. First, you should read the book, if you haven't read the book, right? Because it's easier to talk about wage theft if you can throw around a few figures and numbers, and I got all that junk in the book. Secondly, we're trying to get congregations to use the book as a study. So there's one of the appendices, is a congregational study guide. And we're really hoping that congregations or classes will use it to lift up the issues in the life of the congregation. Thirdly, if you talk to friends and neighbors about the subject, one, you're going to find friends and neighbors who have not been paid, right? It really is all around us. And if it's happened recently, you should help them try and get their money back, right? Because every time we hear about it, we should challenge it. You know, if you talk, you know, go talk to the employer at the wait staff when you find out they're not getting their wages. It matters if folks know that you're watching. So challenge it locally. Fourth, obviously, support the Employee Free Choice Act. It's a really important thing. And, you know, much like In the most recent campaigns were so good at getting you to call your friends in other states. Did any of you do that for one of the campaigns or the other? Maybe I'm from Illinois, so we were all calling everyone outside the state. But you know, that's what we need to do on the Employee Free Choice Act, right? We need to be calling people in some of the states that are considered swing. And Maine is clearly a very swing state on this one, with two senators who are on the fence on this one. So, you know, not far. If you know, got friends in Maine, start talking to them about this issue. Fifth, if you're involved in any contracting, as soon as you hear the word contracting, start looking at what's going on, because contracting is a place of a huge amount of abuse for workers. So if you're in a congregation and they're contracting for building services, they're contracting for construction projects, they're contracting for painting, insert yourself and ask how workers are going to be paid. Because I cannot tell you how many contracting jobs for churches, for schools, for synagogues, for institutions where workers have not been paid fairly. So insert yourself in those contracting discussions. And finally, support the groups around you that are doing this fighting of wage theft. I would strongly urge you, you know, to where are the worker centers that you guys work with? And you could use some volunteers? Absolutely. So if you want to volunteer, the worker centers are a great place to volunteer. We have a mass interfaith group that's engaging the religious community on this. We're also introducing some legislation nationally after the Employee Free Choice Act vote. Would love to have your support and work on that. And so if you want to get on the Interfaith Worker Justice mailing list, just give me your card and I'll get you on our mailing list and get you involved in that. But they're really, you know, again, unlike many of the things that are problems out there, this one, we can solve it. You know, the combination of increasing those pushback forces and all of us getting together can really turn this around. And if we do so, it will not only help working men and women and their families by putting billions of dollars back in their paychecks. It will help ethical businesses because they won't be undercut by unethical ones. It puts money back into the public coffers. And finally, when we're talking about how to stimulate the economy, what better way to stimulate the economy than to actually make sure workers are paid, right? That money is going to get turned around very quickly. So tonight, I just want to say this is indeed a national crisis, but it's a crisis that we can solve, and we can solve it rather quickly, but we got to work together on it. So thank you.
So filmmakers and writers and artists, a lot of us are teaching in these colleges that are one of the major employers in Massachusetts, and most of us are adjunct professors. This is an open secret in the state. The full-time professors are asked to teach either two or three classes per semester and are paid full-time wages. I don't actually know what that is, but adjunct professors, I'm working right now two classes per semester, and I get paid $3,500 per class. So you figure I'm making about $14,000 a year. And you get no pay in between semesters. You get no pay over the summer. There are no benefits. It's just unbelievable. And I hear you talking about immigrant workers and construction workers, but, you know, people working in the professions and particularly in higher education are really desperate for help, desperate. And I'm really just saying, can somebody in this crowd over here help us? Because, you know, we're so overworked and underpaid, there's no possibility of trying to organize, right? You're just trying to keep going. So has there been...
That is the only solution.
What I'm trying to say is we actually need some help. And I just don't know if any of these organizations are thinking about this or trying to do anything about it. I'm making myself available, if you are, to help. But, I mean, obviously...
There's a part-time union. There's an adjunct union.
Is there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Who's organizing the...
So I just want to say, you know, is there research into this nationally about what's going on at the university?
Oh, it's scandalous. You are absolutely right. What is happening to the adjunct faculty is an absolute scandal. Unfortunately, it's not illegal. It's just immoral, right? But it is indeed a scandal what's going on. But the only solution that I know of for that one is for people to organize.
Well, I mean, I think that's fine, but I wouldn't even know who to contact about that.
Great. Organization called the Coalition of Contingent Academic Labor that's actually been quite effective in the Boston area. And their sort of model is to faculty on different campuses, and so that if they're if you need to press for better demands, not that they've been particularly effective about it, but they've been effective in some Boston area campuses, that you'd bring contingent faculty from other campuses onto this campus to make trouble because they're not at all accountable to that administration. An organization which I'm actually a member, a state officer of, but not proudly so, is the American Association of University Professors, and the Boston State Conference, the Massachusetts State Conference has actually done some work in this area, and there's a couple of names of people that I'd be glad to put you in contact with, and the University UMass Boston has actually been pretty effective.
No, I mean, there are a few places that are unionized, and then there are lots and lots that aren't. That's the problem.
And there's it's a big struggle and an important struggle, and one that some people are doing some really innovative work around.
But this is actually one where, let's say we had the Employee Free Choice Act, right? If half of you, you know, if you had the Employee Free Choice Act, half of you could just sign a card and you would go, be able to go to the employer and say, we're a union, you have to negotiate a contract with us. That's what it would be. Yeah, they are. Absolutely, they
are.
And
even if you organize, it doesn't mean that, I mean, you might get steady pay increases and a little bit more money, but it's not like they're going to make you full time. I mean, you know, there's still the issue of the adjunct shuffle and trying to...
Yeah, no, that's right. Right.
Well, I don't see how they can get away with paying, like, some people, you know, a full-time wage for the same work that other people are being paid. Like a fraction. How can they get away with it? Isn't there a law against something like that?
No. There's not laws on many things, right? There's not laws that you have to have vacation pay or sick days or, you know, our laws are pretty, on some level, pretty minimal in terms of standards in the workplace. In fact, one of the, our former Secretary of Labor was known for just every time she made a speech in the last few months, she would say, we've got to be careful that we don't have the Europeanization of the American workforce. What's she talking about, right? Well, she was talking about paid sick days, right? You know, or maybe health care. I don't know, right? But heaven forbid. I mean, we'd all want. I'd like the Europeanization of the workplace, wouldn't you, right? And this is our Secretary of Labor railing against it. What is it? Oh, it's so good she's gone. So good, yeah.
I like the point you made about businesses being undercut if they actually do treat workers fairly. I have a friend who's a contractor in JP, and he does superb work, and he treats, I know for a fact, because he's a friend, that he pays his workers way more than most would get paid on other teams. The problem is that his work costs more. So when people do bidding, and this is an example I run into as an independent bookseller, people want to do the right thing, but when it comes down to price, they often don't do the right thing. They want to support their independent shops, but if they can get it cheaper online or through a chain, they'll do it. Same with my friend. He'll often give a bid for a job, and it's usually quite a bit more than, you know, competition. And he knows that a lot of his competitors are not paying his workers fairly, but he often doesn't get the bid. Yeah. And so I really like the idea of a congregation or, you know, any community organization actually coming up with a list of almost preferred contractors who are known to do good work and also treat their workers fairly.
You know, a few years ago, we put together a little brochure for congregations looking at construction projects. And it doesn't tell you what the right thing to do is, but it helps you know what the right questions are to ask, right? And, you know, the questions are, how are the workers paid? Do they have workers' comp? Are they, you know, do they have health insurance? You know, all those kind of things. And if you answer the questions, you almost always come up that it has to be, you know, ethical employers, and often that's union employers. Not always, right? But It's really, but we don't ask the right questions. We ask the question of how cheap is it? I know this one very well because I came to my office one day. We're located in a Presbyterian church, and there was scaffolding going up around the building. And I have to tell you, my heart went, oh, no, what is this, right? And when the guys started doing tuck pointing up near my office, and the fumes were just unbelievable inside my office where the plastic was up and the guys had no masks on outside, I knew it was a non-union project, right? And so, you know, it wasn't 2 days before, you know, the tuck pointers union is calling me saying, do you work in this church? Yeah. So we negotiated a sort of conversation between the church and the tuck pointers union. And, you know, we said, you know, the tuck pointer said, ask your contractor how they're paying people. They asked them, and he said, oh, we're paying them 1099s, i.e. they were paying them all as independent contractors, right? And the church didn't see anything wrong with that, right? They said, well, what's wrong with that? And I'm going, and they just thought I was crazy, right? But it was a huge problem. So then we started this whole conversation with the presbytery, you know, which is like the judicatory level above the local church, right? And so I go to the building group at the presbytery, right? And at the presbytery level, you know, I said to them, well, you know, what is your mission here as this building group? What are the values? What are you trying to do? And he said to me very clearly, we're trying to help churches get the best quality work for the best price. And I said, well, I think there's a third leg in that stool, and that is fair treatment of workers. And they immediately said, oh, well, if we did that, the price would be out of control, and we couldn't pay it, and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it was interesting because in my conversations then with the union folks, they said, you know what, we'll work with people, right? We'll try and figure out how we get the right sized contractor to do the right kind of job in a way that, you know, we'll try and make the price reasonable for churches. But you got to go in with that third value of paying people fairly. Again, you can work through it with congregations on this stuff, but it takes a little while.
I just wanted to add, in addition to promoting good businesses, showcasing the bad actors, I saw a headline this week that said something about we should bring back the stocks. And I thought of that. I was looking at your book before I came here tonight, and you have a list in the back of all the companies that have had suits settled. And it was shocking to see the companies who are on that list. And I think if consumers were more aware of who is doing this, you know, they can bring pressures to bear too. So
no, that's right, Janet. And that's why really that list in the back, there's two different appendices. One is one on DOL suits that have been settled, and another one is on some private suits that have been settled. And the way we did it, we had to go through all the press releases and try and pull it out, you know, because there was no place you could get the information in a logical way, right? So, yeah, if it were more transparent, it would be easy for us to make those choices. Yeah?
I just want to raise an issue that actually Diego, a lot of people here who work directly with workers, probably surface a little more clearly. There's just so many barriers, especially when you're working with immigrant workers, to helping people who are affected by the problem be involved in fighting for a solution to it. You know, status, whether people have documents or not, the need for the job, you know, indiscriminate firing, lots and lots of barriers. And I just feel like in so many cases that I hear about a lot from Diego and other people, it just feels like the odds are so insurmountable to gaining a positive outcome at times that it's hard to know strategically how to have more impact. And I'm thinking particularly of Cheesecake and other situations where workers at Legal Seafoods and Cheesecake Factory, the cleaning workers are repeatedly not paid their wages or paid under the wages that they're owed, and they just change the name of the cleaning company in order to kind of get that off the books, and it's a repeated pattern. It's nationwide. And yet, you know, even now, it's like, you know, it's hard to take them on.
it's just hard at a level to have take them on in a way that will have impact. And I think in terms of people who are directly suffering from that, to try to break down what those barriers are and if there's any way, in a unified way, that we could help overcome them. I just personally feel at a loss. I mean, every time I hear the cases about strategically, what can you do? I mean, to be honest, even like Dunkin' Donuts workers here last year, a huge amount of the Brazilian community is working at Dunkin' Donuts, and people being, you know, besides consistently being called out on Social Security numbers, it was, you know, a lot of wage issues and the rest, and there was no chance for them theoretically when you looked at it, and they just said, tough. We're still going to complain about it. You know, let's just do something to stop customers coming in to say, this is what happens to people here. And I think that consumer contact is a really important piece. But just, I don't know. I mean, again, I think Diego and other people could speak more directly to this. But we struggle a lot with how can you actually gain even a small victory for people who are really struggling at the bottom rungs. And it's really hard, yeah, you know.
You know, I'll have to say, I've been surprised a little bit at this. But the worker centers, not all of them, but most of them that are working with us, they're doing much less filing anything with a government agency right now because the turnaround is so slow. And in a way that I think is, it's disheartening to me because I just think we need to be pushing those government. But they've, you know, most of them are just like, you know, it's so slow and feels so pointless. You know, the lawsuit stuff, takes forever. What increasingly they're doing that, you know, works is the, you know, we get these little religious prayer teams that go to employers. And, you know, that actually works pretty well. You know, we just took a couple weeks ago. In fact, we've got a little video of this clip. One of my 14-year-old sons helped me do a book website. So it's wagetheft.org. And on wagetheft.org is a video clip that, you know, some Loyola University students made, right? So it's not like, you know, the camera's kind of going like this, right? But it videotapes the set of actions that the Chicago Worker Center did to collect money for workers from Sweet Thang Bakery, which was, you know, it was all immigrant bakers and workers. And you know, we took some clergy and, you know, we're really getting into this doing prayers, you know, at the workplaces and at their homes. And, you know, it, like, really works. The power of prayer, that's exactly right. You know, in Austin, they were telling me that they had this one employer that they had sent a prayer team out to, you know, his doorstep of his home, and they'd, you know, they'd flyered the neighborhood about what a bad employer he was and then prayed on his doorstep and eventually got the guy to just take his checkbook out and pay the workers. It was construction workers. And, you know, it wasn't a month later that they had another group of workers that from the same guy who hadn't been paid. So they called him up and they said, do you want the prayer team to come out? And he said, no, I'll pay. Don't send those people, right? You know, so I really think the benefits for engaging the religious community are not just that they can get the money fast, but it sends such a clear message to the employers that the broad community is watching. And nothing would make this issue more real to the religious community than doing more of these things. And so I just strongly encourage you. And I know we've got this one little organizer, Anthony Zuba, who's with the Mass Interfaith. And I know he really wants to try and help organize some of those religious delegations to help on some of the wage theft stuff. So if he can help you, please tap him, because I've seen the power of it, and I think it's, again, it's not going to solve the whole thing, right? But it's just another little, you know, piece in it.
I think the only last thing I'll add is that the focus of the worker centers that are part of the collaborative is how to do
constituency-based organizing, meaning how to get people who are affected by the problem more clear on the root causes of the problem, more aware and confident about taking action, and more able to take collective action together, and to try to link to unions and others, folks, faith-based folks, and but that process, how to do that, is a lot of their focus. And the collaborative was formed to help them to get better at that process, to really involve the base.
Great.
That's great. I just wanted to add another example of what you were talking about. My son's shula at Workman's Circle in Brookline, just down the street, had a demonstration in front of a local bank in Coolidge Corner and a beauty salon where the cleaners were being paid less than the minimum wage and having their wages withheld. And they were out in a snowstorm on a Sunday. And it got the attention of the community. I don't know what's followed up yet, but I was impressed anyway and proud that my son was excited about it.
Yeah, I also, I do think teenagers and young people have a lot of potential because they often know of folks that are paid under the table or paid less than minimum wage because so many teenagers are exploited in the workplace. So they kind of get it personally, but they have such a sense of justice and injustice. Now, maybe I wouldn't have felt this when I didn't have 14-year-olds, but Mom, you're not fair. But but they really are. I can tell stories all night, but I won't do too many more. But so we're on vacation, right? We're at Glacier National Park, and I'm trying to get away for 6 days, right? So we go to the little lodge restaurant, and they're all H2B workers, right, at the restaurant. And so I'm already like, oh, H2B. I know how this works, right? So my son overhears the manager telling the wait staff to pool their tips, right? To give them all the tips to the manager, right? To put them all into one big collective thing. So my son says, Mom, go talk to the manager. I'm like, honey, I'm on vacation. He says, Mom, go talk to the manager of the hotel. Tell him. Anyway, my child would not stop. I had to go talk to the manager of the hotel. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but I was in the restaurant. We overheard them talking. And you need to really watch it because if, in fact, the managers are sharing in those tips, it's illegal and blah, blah. Anyways. Anyway, but kids can be great, right? They totally get it, so. Good. All right. Thank you so much. Oh, wait. We have a local bookseller here. It's important if you want the book for yourself or your mother that you should buy from the local bookseller, not Amazon. It is true, Amazon's cheaper, but the local bookseller is where you want to go.
Thank you so much, Kim. And I was going to put in a plug that Rhythm and Muse and David and is selling the book. And not only your mom, but think about your employer or some other. One of our, I ask as you, I think Kim will linger. I think she's willing to inscribe books to your mom or your employer. And if you could be so kind as you leave, just to take your chair and put it on that rack over there and helps us set up. So thanks again. Come for check out the calendar of events coming up as you leave. And thanks for coming out tonight in the ice and cold. Oh, and we have our new comic book, Free, The Economic Meltdown Funnies, on the back table. This explains everything about what just happened with the economic crisis.